Why can't Egypt have its own Silicon Valley?
Those 2.5 hours in Tahrir, were you thinking this fund will never just happen?
I started to leave, and I walked to the door. His assistant walked me to the door and said, that was a good meeting. I said, hey, we were in the same meeting as Anand. Your senator is yelling at me because he's angry at Obama for political reasons, and that was to visit the Muslim Brotherhood to hear from them. Said to me, we will meet, we will match it. We will put up $300 million.
Revolutions sometimes tend to produce entrepreneurs, even if they don't produce democracies.
Well, he created a dating app called Harmonica. It was a culturally appropriate dating app for Egypt that exploded.
In 2011, Egypt was in turmoil. Governments were collapsing. Markets froze. A nation teetered on the edge of chaos. Into that storm stepped a small American fund, armed not with tanks or diplomacy, but with capital, and a belief that business could reshape a country. Over the next decade, it faced accusations of spying, deals falling apart, and a market no rational investor would touch. Yet somehow, it built the extraordinary Egyptian-led investment firms, a thriving startup ecosystem, and a new model of influence without force. Today, we hear from the people who lived it, the Egyptian-American Enterprise Fund's chairman, James Harman, and its on-the-ground architect, Cornelius Queen. From Tahrir Square chaos to revolution-born startups, they show how money became a tool for human dignity and a subtle, unstoppable form of soft power. Welcome to From Cairo to New York, Power and Pressure in the New Middle East. I'm Zeina Soufan. Jim and Connie, congratulations on the publication of A Daring Enterprise, a book I thoroughly enjoyed and found both insightful and inspiring. I'd like to take our audience through the remarkable journey behind it. Jim, let me start with you. Take us back to that pivotal phone call from Hillary Clinton in the midst of a revolution with uncertainty gripping Egypt and investors actually heading for the exits. Why did Washington believe that launching an investment fund was the right response? What was the thinking behind betting on Egypt at such a turbulent moment?
First of all, people in the United States were not aware of the turbulence in Egypt as clearly as, of course, there was or that I saw it. And even when Hillary first called me, she said famously, Jim, you can do this. You can do this on 25% of your time. That was the what we call the humor of the day, the joke of the day, because, it ended up being 100% of my time. Even to this day, when I see Hillary, I remind her about her famous line, you can do this on, now, she was trying to convince me to accept, but still, she said you could do it on 25% of your time. I would have to see for myself. And that led me, of course, to, I did accept it several months later. And this was in 2012, is when I got the call. I told her I would do it.
What was the idea behind the fund? What did Hillary Clinton say? Why was Washington interested in even starting that fund?
Washington felt that an enterprise fund helps to create jobs and helps to build the private sector in the country before that. We had not been that successful in other enterprise funds. As you know, it turned out that we were very successful in Egypt in the last 12, 14 years. And that's the story of our book. Why were we so successful? Why can't be done in many other countries? What is it that we did differently to make it so successful? Now,
Let me take you back to the beginnings, Jim. When you arrived in Cairo, what did Egypt look and feel like from an investor's perspective? And what was your conclusion on the way forward?
So on our first trip, I saw violence in Tahrir that I hadn't expected. In fact, our car on our first trip, I had made a decision, which the government of the United States didn't agree with, but I had the right to do it. And that was to visit the Muslim Brotherhood to hear from them, even though we had no intention of doing any business with them. I wanted to hear what they had to say. In driving to meeting, the cars all over the square were being burnt or turned over, or there was a violence. It was not, and certainly was not against the United States. It was protests in Egypt because people didn't have jobs. People were unhappy with their own government at the time. Oh, I did not know that when I arrived, and I saw it clearly on the first trip. So it took me 2.5 hours to get through. You get to the first meeting, which I had selected the Brotherhood as the first meeting, that which my government disagreed with me on. And I said, oh, I will learn something. Even if we never do business with them, I will learn something from the meeting. But the 2.5 hours was a difficult trip.
Those 2.5 hours in Tahrir with chaos all around, were you thinking this fund will never just happen?
I did think that in Egypt, with this kind of chaos, there's no way I could put Americans on the ground to look for investments. So quickly, I decided I had to find the Egyptians. Fortunately, if there was one conclusion I reached them, and I have always felt since then, there is a lot of talent in Egypt. And so we just had to find out who could help us the most and help us to lead it. I didn't learn that until the second trip. The first trip with El Shatta at the Brotherhood, and I learned what they had to say. And they surprised me, because in the very first meeting, they said, we will match the American $300 million that the Congress had proposed will help us invest in Egypt. We will match it. We want to be your partner. Now, I told them I didn't think that was likely, but I thanked them for it. There was no amenities, no tea, no coffee, nothing served. It was not a usual Egyptian meeting, and it didn't start till very late because we had been stuck in the square. But when it started, Al-Shatta said to me, we will match it. We will put up $300 million. I had not expected that. So I tried to gracefully thank him, but I said I didn't think that was likely. He was not going to partner with the Egyptian, with the Brotherhood.
What was your objective from carrying out that meeting? What did you want to understand at that point, Jim?
To me, I had been told that the Brotherhood represented maybe half people in Egypt. It was a large number. So my objective was to learn from them. What is it? What are they intending to do? Are they going to build the private sector? What are they going to do? Now, El Shatta kept on saying to me, if we did this together, when we put up $300 million, the U.S. puts up $300 million, we will show you how to make investments so that you will be successful and we will have a stronger private sector. That was their objective. Of course, I didn't believe it. So I did learn enough in that meeting to know what they had intended to do. And of course, I had with me two very bright young women. One was Egyptian, and the other was from the State Department. And both of them were a bit frightened by the nature of the meeting, because the meeting was held in this home outside of Cairo, and El-Sheth is a tall, large, well, strongly strong opinion. He didn't let anybody in his group speak. Only he spoke, and I spoke, and the women and Mike were with me didn't speak. So it was literally a 3+ hour meeting in which he told me what he could do for us. And I said, well, thank you. I didn't think it was going to work that way. We would have to find others here. But I expressed my appreciation for his opinion. Remember, I had made the decision to meet with the Brotherhood. My own government, the State Department, disagreed with me. But since I was a private citizen, I had left the government. They couldn't tell me what to do. But I chose to meet with, quote, the party that represented so many people, to listen to see what they had to say and what they thought the people were. So I learned a little bit.
So you decided you could not do business with the Muslim Brotherhood, and you thought that finding the right Egyptian partner was going to be very critical to your success. Who was Ashraf Zaki, Jim? Why did he become such a pivotal figure in the story?
I'm, of course, left that first day knowing that there was a lot of talent in Egypt. There were a lot of capable people in Egypt. Now I had to find who could do it. So I asked my Egyptian assistant at the time, Ola El Chawabi, Ola, who do you think is the richest man in Egypt? Who is the most successful business person? I'd like to ask him a question. She says, Nosef Sawiris. He is most capable, and I know his assistant. So I said, let's get him on the phone. He, right there, in as we met in the square, in the violence, she gets his assistant on the phone and tells him what we're going to do. And he says he'll meet with me. But literally, I'm flying to London next day. So this was Thursday of the first week. We flew to London, and I met the forces. And he said, let me see the list of your candidates. And on that list were a lot of people who I have since done business with. And I'm surprised. They're all good people. But when I meet with Nosef, he says to me, none of them can do what you need. I have the person who can do it. It's my bank, my advisor, a man named Ashraf Zaki. So I listened to him and I set a meeting with Ashraf immediately. And he came to New York. And he had an interesting meeting, because I had in mind right away that he's good. And the talent just in Egypt that we could do business together. And so I proposed to work for us. Ryan, I offered him a compensation, $500,000 a year. And he said to me, in kindness, I am not interested in working for the United States government. I will not at this point in my life take any position at any price with the U.S. government. And so I excused myself from it. I went into my conference room and I told my assistant, I got to come up with a different approach. And I didn't come up with it. So we came back together and I said, Asher, we'll work for you. That was a negotiation, but He said, what does that mean? We'll work for me. And I said, we'll provide you with enough for you to start a fund. And you will make investments and we will approve the investments. Neil, we work every Sunday. I promise you we will work 5 times a week if necessary, but we will go through it. But I knew even in the first few meetings with Ashraf that he and I could work together, but he did not want to work for the U.S. government. And so what I thought initially is a big setback, because in the first meeting, I started at 500,000. I went up to 1 million. So he made for $1 million, he would not work on this project for us. And he said, I'm not going to work for the U.S. government, period, in the conversation. So I said, okay, we'll work for you. But he said, what does it mean?
Jim, allow me to bring Connie into the conversation here. Connie, the business model upon which the fund was established bears similarity to private equity funds, but it's not one, nor is it a venture capital fund. Would you say it has a very unique DNA that was perhaps dictated by its birth conditions and somewhat shaped by its mission and its raison d'etre?
Yes, Zaina, thank you for the question. The Enterprise Fund is a unique model because it blends elements of private equity and venture capital along with a development focus, because our mission, as you know, was to support the development of Egypt's private sector. So we were established as a private investment fund by the U.S. Congress in 2011 to help grow Egypt's private sector. Our board of directors is a board of directors with deep and extensive private sector experience. It's formed of 6 Americans and 3 Egyptian citizens, all of whom have extensive private sector expertise. And they're given the autonomy by the U.S. government to use this congressional funding to help stimulate the private sector in Egypt. And they do that based on a strategy where they leverage their experience investing in emerging markets and private sector to help stimulate the private sector in the best way that they see it possible. But in our case, it's very important that we also have a development mandate. So we have a commitment to grow the private sector. Early on, there was a specific focus on micro, small, and medium-sized enterprises, and that's why we invested in Fowry, which reaches 55 million Egyptians and several hundred thousand small businesses with access to capital. So we do have a development component as part of our mandate, but we also have elements of a private sector investment fund.
Jim, one of the surprises of the book is that at the beginning, one of the obstacles that faced the fund was not from Cairo, but it came from Congress. What happened inside Congress? And how did the Lindsey Graham hold become a defining moment? And how close did the project come to dying before it even started investing?
That occurred after we had started and after Ashraf and I had worked it out. And frankly, it occurred after I had made a lot of progress with Ashraf, and even after we had found Fowry. Lindsey Graham placed a hold, and I met with him in his office. It was an ugly meeting because he was raising his voice. Sometimes senators in the United States think they are God, they think they can do anything. He is yelling at me. I'm not doing it. I didn't know in the meeting that he was really so angry at Obama, not at me, not at the Enterprise Fund. He didn't like Obama, and Obama had asked me to take this assignment. So he had been in Egypt before, and he knew Egypt. But he said, I've had enough with you. And it was a pretty tough exchange in which he insulted me. And I never really understood at first. I just listened to him scream at me. One of the more amusing parts of that meeting, which was 2 hours of him yelling at me, as I said, I started to leave, and I walked to the door. His assistant walked me to the door and said, "That was a good meeting." I said, "Were you in the same meeting as I was?" Your senator is yelling at me because he's angry at Obama for political reasons. That's a good meeting. I've been in a lot of meetings in my life, but I wouldn't call that a good meeting. So his assistant literally walks me down to the end of the hall and keeps on telling me, pretty constructive meeting. And I keep on saying to him, "You must have been in the wrong meeting, because that was not a good meeting." And I knew that I had a problem with what started out as being Lindsey Graham. It were five other senators, one by one, who were so unhappy with Obama. And in our country, they could express these kinds of strong feelings without necessarily being angry at me. So I thought, I'm never going to get this thing off the ground if they're going to put polls on our funding and I can't get the money. Then even though I found Ashraf, and even though I thought Egypt had talent, and I was optimistic then that we could do it in Egypt, but I have real questions with the holes that were being placed on me. That probably was the most discouraging moment. I thought, I'll never get through this thing if they don't give me the money. It sounded like they were so annoyed that nothing would happen. So I would say that was one of the more unpleasant, difficult meetings. And to this day, I don't think I've had a meeting with another senator.
So what happened, Jim, afterwards? So the ban was lifted in December 2013.
Time changed. Time over time, Obama did things which Lindsey Graham felt, well, maybe it's not so terrible. And fortunately, Lindsey Graham and his colleague, was another senator, visited Egypt. And they said, We should do this because we should help Egypt. And so the meeting in Egypt and the meeting with me, but I didn't let it get out of hand, even though in the private sector, I might have walked out of that office and not talked to him again. I put up with every time he called me. I took the meeting and I made the effort to work with him. And once he felt that he didn't have to express his anger at Obama, that maybe Egypt, which he had visited, as I said, maybe we should do the Egyptian Enterprise Fund. When that happened, I thought, wow, now I just overcame. But that took me 6-7 months just to get him and the other people, the others who placed hold, were all... Maybe they didn't yell and scream, but they were very, very angry.
And for months after the ban was lifted, you and Ashraf worked on your first deal. You planned to buy Piraeus Bank. The project somewhat collapsed after months of preparations. What happened?
But by the way, during this period that we're describing, the difficulties I had with our own Senate, the Egyptian government was expressing their own displeasure in pretty strong terms. There was one or two people I remember very well who didn't want to meet with me when I had a meeting. They walked out of the meeting because they felt that somehow we should have given them the $300 million. It kept on saying to me, "Don't do this thing with whoever you found." They didn't know yet that it was Ashraf. They didn't care whether it was Egyptian or not. And they didn't care whether they put Americans on. They just said, "The $300 million, you've taken them away from something that the Americans had planned here a year or two ago." So they felt they had to tell me we should give them the money. And of course, there was no way that I could do that. So I was saying, by then, that's the first year or so, I had had enough disagreements with the people in the anger in my own government against Obama, taking it out on me. And then I found that even if I look in there, the Egyptians felt that they should give them the money. So by the time Ashraf and I held our first investment, when the family started to work together, I had been through enough and I couldn't help being, what was we doing here? I didn't need this. I had a successful life, wonderful family, birth requirement. I didn't need the aggravation of fighting with my own government, and I didn't need Jiu-Jitsu them and pulling them out. So 2014, let's say, by then I had plenty of second thoughts about taking this whole assignment. Well, and then fortunately I stayed the course and Ashraf and I had talked to somebody. He said if you could find an Egyptian bank which could make loans, it would be a good start. So I agreed with it. Let's do it. Let's find the bank. If he finds the Piraeus, which is owned by the Greek family, but it's part, it's an Egyptian bank, I thought they will show some between me, Ben, and Paul. We made a proposal with them very shortly afterwards. We would buy the bank for its book, which was $75 million. That was easy decision. I said, let's go. I thought we would be there. Unfortunately, me and the law said that government on the bank in Egypt. And they did not want an American enterprise firm, the man who was with me, to own an Egyptian bank. So that took a while for them to tell me that we're giving you to not and say you can't do it. We had a dinner in Washington. I was usually next to the local social banker from Egypt. And but this was good idea to talk about. Well, here's what we're going to do. As soon as I sat down, we stood up and moved to another table. We didn't want to sit next to me. Came down, made a decision. They will not let the American buy a bank, even though that bank was already owned by another country. It was an Egyptian bank that put that one American vehicle to own it. So that was another setback. So black metal, by 2014, the Polonius bank deal collapsed because he couldn't get approval from Egypt.
Looking back, was the rejection about banking regulations, or was it about politics and the state of U.S.-Egypt relations at the time? I mean, you write in the book about being accused of being an American spy on Egyptian television. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, so that is true. I was invited to participate in this evening discussion I describe in the book by someone who was very popular in Egypt. It was a very popular.
Ahmed Adib.
Very popular program. And I welcomed the chance to tell our story and maybe make some progress. So I went on the program. I took with me a very capable Egyptian American, who I knew quite well, And he hadn't been back in Egypt for a while, but I thought, well, at least he understood a little Arabic, which I didn't. That on quote television interview, they started out by saying to me, he said to me, very directly, are you an American spy? Are you an American spy? And I remember telling him, I'm too old to be a spy. I'm not about to do this at this point in my life. We spent the first half hour, 15, 20 minutes, just saying to him, I am not a spy. Let's go on to other things.
Finally, in September 2015, a consortium that you organized struck an agreement to buy a majority stake in Fauri for $100 million. That was your first deal, and that was one of the largest acquisitions of a technology company in Egyptian history.
Yes.
How did the collapse of the Piraeus deal lead you or push you towards Fauri? What was the logic behind the move?
So the first thing I would say, and you tell it, it was 2015, the first 3 years of working on this project, 3 years, the struggle we had between the Egyptian government telling me give us the money and not wanting to do it, and my own government angry at Obama telling me that they're going to put holes on it. I tell you, why would I possibly take this assignment? I mean, I really questioned my wisdom by then. I couldn't seem to get a grip on it. I finally found Ashraf, and I thought we were on our way with Piraeus. Then Piraeus deal falls apart. So I had been through a lot of disappointments and setbacks in the first 2 or 3 years. And I think back on the day that Hillary Clinton called and said to me, you can do this on 25% of your time. I was working 100% of my time and I had gotten nowhere. But then things turned. Then, life is, Ashraf came to me and we talked about Fauri. I knew almost immediately that this was an exciting company and we could invest in it and it could make a difference. So I have to say, after a fair number of time of being depressed by setbacks and struggles, something occurred that I call it, this could change it all. So temperature went, normal, and I felt this is life, this is an opportunity. And with Ashraf, who by then I really had been working closely with, who I liked a lot, there's a lot of talent in Egypt and a lot of talent that he could attract. So with him guiding us, and the talent that existed in Egypt, we felt we had overcome six holes, which were with my own people in Washington, my own government, one after another, yelling at me, we're not going to let you do it. The politics in the United States was so annoying to me that it's amazing that I was fortunately successful enough and I had a wonderful family and I lived here that I could basically put up with all this and go forward. And when we found Fauri, then life looked like it could turn around.
So, Connie, you joined after a major devaluation event at the end of 2016. How did that event position the fund, the American Egyptian Enterprise Fund, as the most significant institutional investor in the Egyptian market at that time?
Sure. So I think you have to take a step back to 2011. And after the revolution, a lot of foreign investment had fled Egypt at the time. And so there were very little foreign investors. There was Abraj, there was Actis, and for various reasons, they pulled out of the market or they redirected their capital to other parts of the emerging market landscape. In our case, when we first arrived, there was a very limited domestic private equity and venture capital ecosystem. And because some of the larger foreign regional investors had already left, that placed us in a position where we were probably one of the largest foreign investors in Egypt. And I think we were coming in at a time where there was very little foreign investment. And we had a significant amount of capital. $300 million is not a lot in maybe other markets, but in Egypt, $300 million signified a significant amount of capital to help stimulate the private sector. And when the U.S. is putting up that capital, it has a signaling effect to other investors that the U.S. is taking the Egyptian private sector and the economy seriously. So I think when we came in right around 2014, 2015 with our first investments, this was right before the devaluation. And so our investment partners were able to develop an investment strategy where they invested in companies that could withstand these severe macroeconomic shocks and actually thrive and emerge stronger from shocks like a devaluation. So when we invested early on in Contact and Fowry, we were coming in right before the devaluation, but we were able to take advantage of some of the larger macroeconomic reforms that accompanied the devaluation and the IMF reforms as part of the 2016 IMF agreement. So we were, I think, well situated to really take advantage, along with our partners on the ground, of this new emerging investment landscape post-devaluation 2016.
Connie, one of the most fascinating arguments made in the book is that revolutions sometimes tend to produce entrepreneurs, even if they don't produce democracies.
Sure. Well, I think after the revolution, as you know best, there was a lot of optimism and there was a lot of cause for celebration because a lot of people felt that Egypt was at a turning point. And I think a lot of that optimism was driven by the youth population. Egypt has a very sizable youth population. Many of them were out in the streets of Tahrir protesting against the Mubarak regime, calling for change. And so I think there was a swell of optimism and excitement about a new Egypt and really transforming the country to meet some of these larger democratic and economic aspirations that folks on the ground had. They were protesting. And I think along with that excitement came a rush of entrepreneurship and I think an interest in creating businesses from young people to help really transform the country, but also create jobs for their fellow citizens and to really help them, I think, channel their creativity and to do something positive for themselves and Egyptian society and the economy as a whole. So I think this was a real cause for celebration, and I think there was a lot of excitement around entrepreneurship and from the youth population because entrepreneurship was seen as a way to affect change in Egypt and to help create jobs and to help transform a society, not even on a diplomatic basis, but more on a economic front in terms of growing the private sector and creating jobs.
Connie, why does Sameh Saleh's harmonica story capture something important about post-revolution Egypt and about what the fund was trying to achieve?
Sure. Sameh Saleh's story is very exciting. As you know, he created a dating app called Harmonica. It was a culturally appropriate dating app for Egypt that exploded. That was eventually sold to the Match Group, which is a large dating conglomerate business here in the United States that owns Hinge, OkCupid, several other dating apps. So for us, that investment, which was made through our fund manager, Flat Six Labs, was really, I think, you know, it is, you know, the epitome of the potential of Egypt's entrepreneurial ecosystem. I mean, Sema is a serial entrepreneur. He was living in Malaysia at the time. He was working for an oil and gas company. His sister was in the process of potentially having a suitor found for her by her family. And she realized she didn't want to marry someone that she didn't know. And so her brother, this serial entrepreneur, stayed up all night and decided to create a dating app. So he and his sister and other women in Egypt didn't necessarily have to be forced into an old school style of marriage. And they could find their own partners. And I think, you know, Sema's experience really for us epitomizes the best of, you know, the entrepreneurial ecosystem in Egypt. And I think, you know, as part of our own mandate, growing the private sector, venture capital is critical. We see in the United States that venture capital is a critical part of economic growth here. It creates jobs and develops new technologies that transforms lives. And so we like to think, as part of our private sector development, why can't Egypt have its own Silicon Valley?
Connie, walk me through the logic behind backing managers like Lorax, TCV, Algebra Ventures, Flat Six Labs, which you just mentioned, and others, rather than investing directly in everything yourselves.
Sure. Well, I think early on, based on Jim's experience arriving in Egypt in 2012 and experiencing some of the challenges that he faced politically on the ground, not only from our own government in the United States, but also challenges with the Egyptian government and what was a fluid operating environment. He realized early on you couldn't put Americans on the ground in that kind of environment. It really made sense to rely on local Egyptian business talent to help us invest and source investments. And fortunately, Egypt, as you know, is a population of 100 million people. It's right at the gateways of Africa, the Middle East, and Europe. And there's a reservoir of human talent in Egypt, and a lot of really talented investment professionals that have worked abroad at Morgan Stanley, at EFG Hermes, and elsewhere throughout Europe, the United States, and the Middle East. And so Egypt isn't lacking for talent. So it made sense for us to really rely on these local investment managers to help us source and manage our investment portfolio in Egypt, because they're better equipped to understand the local market and really find investments that could really align with our investment strategy. And I would say, in the context of broader private sector development, creating first-time fund managers in Egypt, supporting first-time fund managers in private equity and venture capital, actually has the effect of creating a long-term, sustainable, inclusive private sector that continue to invest in Egypt and attract foreign capital into the country, even after all of these fund managers that we've supported and helped stand up are going to be investing in Egypt into the future. So if we can help grow and seed this crop of future investment managers in Egypt, and venture capital and private equity, then that helps grow the private sector ultimately. It does it in a way that's locally led. And I think that's a critical point, because investing directly with Americans, you know, from Washington or New York, or even going back and forth, just wouldn't have the same effect as relying on folks on the ground who understand the local market and continue to invest and manage portfolio investments into the future. So I think it's part of our mandate has always been, how do we support Egyptian private equity capital ecosystem so that keep investing into the future and attracting foreign capital even after the enterprise fund eventually leaves.
So how do you measure the actual extent of success of this model?
So I think in our case, we measure success on a financial and development basis. Again, we have a mandate to help support the private sector in Egypt, but we also want to generate returns so we could show other investors that you can invest profitably in Egypt. And so on a financial basis, we've almost doubled the money of the U.S. government. So we received $300 billion from Congress. And today, the current estimated market value of our portfolio is north of $500 million. So we've almost doubled the money of the taxpayer. We're still not done investing in Egypt. And so we're very excited that there'll be future returns and additional exits on the horizon. And so I think on a financial basis, we've demonstrated that you can invest profitably in Egypt. And I would just add, we've done that despite several devaluations. So the currency has lost, as you know, over 80% of its value over the last 10 years. But we've still been able to generate, with the help of our investment managers on the ground in Egypt, dollar returns despite what has been a very challenging macroeconomic time. So I would say on a financial basis, we've demonstrated you can make money in Egypt. And then on a developmental basis, we're very proud of the developmental impact we've had on the ground in Egypt. We support 7 first-time fund managers, as I mentioned, across venture capital and private equity. Our investment portfolio includes over 90 companies today that actively support around 70,000 Egyptian jobs. And I would say one of the key investments that we're proud of, among many others, is the Fowry investment. Fowry, as you know, is the largest digital payments platform in Egypt. It extends basic financial services to 55 million Egyptians, almost half the population. And it also extends basic financial services to the small kiosk that serve as a point of sale for the Fawry terminals. Individuals in Egypt can pay their bills in Egypt. And these small businesses are actually able to attract and receive funding from Fawry. So I think on a developmental basis, Fawry is a significant investment because it's able to extend financing to over half the population in Egypt using digital financial services in a market where many Egyptians are still unbanked or underbanked.
Jim, the book argues that this model represents a different form of influence. What exactly does an investment fund achieve that military aid or traditional development programs often cannot?
That's a very important question. And clearly, one of the most important conclusions that I can draw from 15 years of working in the Enterprise Fund is that patients with the talent that existed in Egypt, but patients and finding Ashraf, we were able to make enough progress on our full investment would lead to a lot of other successes. So it was a huge turn of events, because you had asked earlier, there were numbers of times in the first 2-3 years where I questioned my wisdom as to why I was doing this. Now I could see that even with the annoyance of my own politics, even with the Egyptian government questioning it, 300 million, all of these difficult things, we had now found an investment. And with Ashraf's help, I felt we would do very well, and this could lead to a whole series of other investments. And the enterprise funds, if this leadership of the enterprise fund had patience, and that I had enough patience to wait my own politics out and wait my own annoyance with the government of Egypt at the time, we hit a real success with Fawry, and I met with Afel Sabri, and the more I spent time with Fawry, the more excited I got that this would be a big success in Egypt and could lead us to do a number of other investments.
Connie, would you say that this type of investment fund provides an alternative method of influence to that of China's investment method on one hand and Gulf capital on the other?
Yeah, I would say what's unique about our model is that it's locally led. We're not parachuting Americans or citizens from our country to run these businesses, to invest the capital, and then ultimately to take, you know, whatever is gained and extract that out of Egypt. Everything we do is locally led, and it's based on growing the private sector. And so that's our long-term developmental focus. We really want to grow the private sector so Egypt can be a more stable country, a more stable partner to the United States, and that it can provide jobs for Egyptians. And so I think our focus really is on growing local homegrown talent in Egypt. And to the extent that, you know, we can generate a return and signify to other investors that you can invest profitably in Egypt, generate a return for our own taxpayer, I think that ultimately this is a win-win. It helps make the case back at home that you can do development that pays for itself, that has strong economic and development returns. And then locally, it helps grow the private sector in Egypt. And I think building those relationships between our countries is something that you don't see in some of these alternative development models that you mentioned. And I would just say, currently, the U.S. has spent over $30 billion on the current conflict with Iran. Imagine if we had only taken a small slice of that $30 billion and we had invested it, you know, throughout the Middle East through different enterprise funds. I think, you know, we would have had, even a better return on potential investment in terms of growing relationships and you know, promoting our long-term interests in the region, but also promoting and advancing long-term security. So I think if you only took a small sliver of some of the military assistance we see in the region that's put forth in the United States and redirected that towards enterprise funds and creating relationships and building local private sectors, we really have a lot of long-term, I think, prosperity throughout the region and you have better relationships between countries.
If you were designing right now another enterprise fund, where would you deploy it first in this region?
That's a good question. Ultimately, the decision to create an enterprise fund and where to put it is a political one. But I would say Syria is obviously a strong candidate for an enterprise fund. There's a lot of foreign interest in helping rebuild Syria after its civil war. And I think there's interest from the Gulf. There's interest from Europe, obviously, in the United States. And so I think there's a lot of capital that could be channeled into Syria. You know, if the U.S. were to create an enterprise fund, and I think that would be a signal to other investors that the U.S. is serious. I mean, other candidates are obviously Lebanon one day, the Palestinian territories, Iraq, for example. So I think there's a lot of possibilities to create enterprise funds, and there's a lot of talent throughout the Middle East that, you know, they would likely be very successful. And there's obviously, as you know, huge diaspora populations, Lebanon being one of them. And I think there'd be a lot of interest in and excitement, exciting business talent that could come back and help grow the Lebanese private sector, for example. But the same goes for Syria and Iraq and several other countries. And so I think really, you know, many countries are great candidates in the region for an enterprise fund.
Connie, would you say that the center of gravity in the Middle East is slowly shifting towards investors, founders, and capital allocators?
Yeah, I would certainly say so. I think from our experience in Egypt, we've really seen the exponential growth story, really, in the private sector. I mean, you know, like I mentioned, after 2011, 2012, there was very little foreign investment. And I think we've seen in the last 10 years and been able to play just a small part in it is the growth and the explosion of private equity and venture capital in Egypt specifically. As you know, Egypt had a very nascent venture capital ecosystem post-2011, but it's grown exponentially over the last 10 years. And now Egypt's one of the fastest growing startup ecosystems in the Middle East. It's the third largest, I believe, in the top three or the top five in all of Africa. So I think you're seeing a lot of interest from international investors, even investors from the United States, from Silicon Valley, who are taking an interest in Egypt, the exciting startup ecosystems outside of the country. So I think the case is there for why the Middle East is an attractive investment destination. I think in our own example, Egypt demonstrated that you can generate returns, but also have a strong development impact to help grow local ecosystem, whether it be venture capital and private equity. And so I think going forward, there should be a lot more interest and excitement in the region. And we're looking forward to telling our story and helping make the case for why Egypt and you know, other countries should deserve further attention from international investors.
Finally, Jim, as wars and conflict continue to reshape the Middle East, what lessons from Egypt remain relevant today?
Egypt is a large country of over 100 million people. Egypt is important to the United States for all sorts of security reasons. We, the United States, have not done well, in my judgment, in the Middle East in recent years. We have a war going on, which may get worse. So if you look at what we've done in the Middle East, it is not a success story. So one has to say, what should we do differently? Our story, when told, and I haven't, as I said, we've not told the story until we wrote this book. Our story is a success story for the United States. It's not a success story necessarily for Jim Harmon or any of my directors. It's a success story for the United States that we stayed the course. And because of the talent, and mostly because of Ashraf's help with me and Fowey starting it, we have a success in Egypt that will lead, in my judgment, to other enterprise funds being formed around the world by the United States. I have three really significant takeaways from my 15 years in Egypt. One is clearly finding a chairman, like it was me, who would stay around and put up with the annoying difficulties that I had at the beginning. That's helpful. That got us past the difficult period to the point of Fowey. That's very significant. Secondly, that in most countries, including Egypt, there is a respect for the United States business acumen, that the United States is a good business partner to have. So I felt that was important. Now I had to just execute. But enterprise funds could be successful in a number of other countries for the United States, but for other countries, it should be part of our foreign policy. That's what I write in the book. It should be part of the foreign policy. We should tell a story so other countries can do it.
Let me bring this question to Connie too. So as we're witnessing this conflict in the region and seeing really, Connie, the limits of hard power, would you say the model of the enterprise fund could be an alternative way of forging alliances and making for a better future and more win-win situations?
Yes, absolutely. I think at its core, I mean, this is a book about the importance of soft power in the Middle East, where we're now seeing the limits of hard power on a daily basis. Our quiet success story, which we believe represents a real bright spot for U.S. foreign policy in the region, offers an alternative investment-driven model that can really advance a long-term economic security and stability in the region and elsewhere. And right now, interestingly enough, the administration here in the United States is actively looking to scale up the enterprise fund model as part of their commercial diplomacy focus. So while the fund and while the narrative centers around Egypt and the fund, we think that our story really offers a broader argument for how the U.S. can advance its foreign policy goals through this model of soft power that's investment driven, that generates returns, and that is a win-win, not only for the United States, but also the countries where enterprise funds operate in Egypt.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Connie. As wars rage across the region and governments once again debate power, security, and influence, the story we've discussed today raises a different question. What if lasting influence isn't built through pressure alone? What if it comes from relationships, investment, opportunity, and the institutions that outlive political cycles? The Egyptian American Enterprise Fund won't settle the debate over America's role in the Middle East, but its story suggests that some of the most enduring forms of influence are often the least visible. Not troops, not headlines, not even governments, just people building businesses, creating jobs, taking risks, and forming partnerships that survive long after political moments pass. In a region often defined by conflict, that may be one of the more important lessons worth considering. This is From Cairo to New York, Power and Pressure in a New Middle East. I'm Zeina Soufan. See you next time.